Welcome back to the deep dive. Okay, grab your helmet because today we are strapping ourselves into, well, maybe the fastest time machine ever built.
Sounds ambitious.
Right. We're moving way beyond tracking those small genetic shifts within, you know, a single population. That's microevolution.
Yep. Changes within a species, like tracking allele frequencies, P and Q values, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Today we are diving into macroevolution. This is evolution at the really big scales.
Yeah.
Above the population level.
We're talking huge groups, massive trends over geologic time.
Precisely. We're not looking at gene pools anymore. We're tracking the rise and fall of entire species, huge taxa, the major patterns shaping life on Earth. This is our crash course, our shortcut to understanding those vast changes.
Let's start with the scale then, because honestly, it's almost impossible to really wrap your head around casually. Dr. Hossmann puts the Earth's age at about 4.6 billion years.
Yeah, and just for context, the entire universe is maybe only three times older, around 14 billion. So Earth's been around a while.
A long while, and it had a really slow, quiet start, life-wise.
Incredibly slow.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty hellish at first. That first billion years or so, the Hadean eon, means hellish for a reason. Intense heat, no life.
This is a rock and fire.
Pretty much. Life finally gets going around 3.5 billion years ago. And what was it? The simplest stuff. Prokaryotes.
Single cell?
Single cell. And here's the kicker Dr. Hoffman highlights. Prokaryotes had the planet to themselves for almost 2 billion years.
Wow. So like 80% of life's entire history on this planet was just these tiny single-celled organisms figuring things out.
That's it. Everything we think of as complex life, everything familiar, that's the real newcomer.
That's a key insight.
Definitely. Eukaryotes, you know, the cells with the nucleus, more complex structures,
mm-hmm.
they don't show up until maybe 1.8 billion years ago.
And us, and dinosaurs, trees, fish.
All crammed into the last half billion years. The Phanerozoic eon, geologically speaking, it's like the last few seconds on a 24-hour clock. A blink. Okay, that scale is vital. But it begs the question, how do we actually know these dates? We've got fossils, like stromatolites.
Right, fossilized bacterial mats, some of the oldest evidence.
And they give us relative dating.
Yeah.
You know, you look at rock layers, the strata, and deeper generally means older.
Sure, that gives you sequence, but not the actual number, not that 4.6 billion figure.
So how do we get that absolute age?
For that, we need the molecular clock, specifically using radioactive isotopes.
Ah, radioactivity.
Yeah, the basic idea is some atoms are unstable. They have, say, too many neutrons, and they decay. They change into something else over time.
And this decay happens predictably.
Absolutely predictably. That's the key. It makes them a clock.
Which brings us to the half-life concept. I think this sometimes confuses people. It's not like a battery draining steadily down to zero, is it?
No, not linear at all. It's exponential decay. It follows a curve. A half-life is simply the time it takes for half of the original radioactive stuff, the parent isotope, to decay into the daughter isotope.
So if you start with, say, a billion atoms, after one half-life, you have 500 million left. Wait that exact same amount of time again, and you're down to 250 million. Another half-life, 125 million. You always have what's remaining.
And because that rate is constant for each isotope.
We can work backward. We measure the ratio of parent to daughter isotopes in a sample. And knowing the half-life, we can calculate how long it's been decaying.
And the clock starts ticking effectively when an organism dies.
Exactly. While it's alive, it's constantly exchanging materials with its environment, taking in carbon, potassium, whatever, including the radioactive isotopes. So it has the same ratio as the environment.
But when it dies,
that exchange stops. The radioactive isotopes it contained just start decaying and nothing new comes in. So the clock starts. By measuring what's left, we get the time since death.
Okay, so deep time, check. Molecular clocks, check. What else drives macroevolution? Dr. Hoffman points to something huge, the Earth itself moving. He described the crust not as a solid shell, but as thin rafts.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. Thin rafts floating on a much more fluid, dynamic interior, the mantle and core.
This is plate tectonics, continental drift.
Exactly. It's the engine of huge geographical change. Continents aren't fixed. They smash together, they break apart, they slide around.
And the organisms living on them?
They're just along for the ride, like passengers on these enormous, incredibly slow-moving rafts. And this movement, this drift, is a massive driver of evolution.
How so?
Isolation. It's the ultimate source of large-scale isolation.
Like with Kmingia, about 250 million years ago, right?
Yeah.
all the land masses were basically one giant continent.
Mm-hmm. And then it started breaking up, first into two big chunks, Laurasia and Gondwana, and then splitting further into the continents we know today.
So populations that were once connected suddenly found themselves separated by oceans.
Instant geographic isolation on a massive scale. And that's the perfect setup for allopatric speciation evolution happening in isolation. Different environments, different pressures, they just start diverging. Geography literally forces life down different evolutionary paths.
So that's a major external driver. But Dr. Hoffman also talked about internal drivers, like changes in function over these vast timescales. The example of the mammalian skull evolution was pretty striking.
Oh, it's fascinating. You see how function can completely shift over millions, even hundreds of millions of years. Mm. So go back maybe 300 million years to our reptile-like and amphibian-like ancestors.
Okay.
Certain small bones in their skulls were really important for the jaw hinge. You know, a structural job helping with biting and chewing.
Right, a mechanical function.
But as mammals evolved, the jaw structure changed quite a bit. Those particular little bones weren't so crucial for the hinge anymore.
They became kind of leftover parts.
Sort of. They became reduced, changed shape, changed location.
Yeah.
And actually got completely repurposed for something totally different.
Granted, new purpose.
Critical for us mammals. They became the tiny bones in our middle ear, the auditory ossicles, the hammer, anvil, and stirrup. Malleus, ingoiticus, stapes.
No way. From jaw support to hearing.
Yep. They now transmit sound vibrations from the eardrum to the inner ear. It's a perfect example of evolution tinkering, modifying existing structures for new roles, not just inventing things from scratch.
Okay, so we have immense time and we have these engines of change like continental drift and functional shifts. What determines if a whole group of organisms, a lineage, becomes successful or just fizzles out?
Dr. Hoffman boils it down really nicely. The size or success of any group, any taxon, depends on the balance between two rates. Speciation, which is making new species.
And extinction, losing species.
Exactly. It's a constant push and pull.
We see the speciation side really dramatically sometimes, right? Like adaptive radiation.
Yeah, adaptive radiation is when a lineage just explodes, relatively speaking, generating many new species in a fairly short amount of geological time. You see it as a wide flare on a phylogenetic tree.
And it's not like all groups do this equally.
Not at all. Think about mammals. Yeah, De Hoffman contrasts the monotremes, that's the platypus and echidnas, egg-laying mammals.
Just a few species left.
Very few. Compare them to the eutherians, the placental mammals. That includes us, bats, whales, rodents.
A huge, diverse group.
Overwhelmingly successful in terms of the number of species generated. Why? Often it's opportunity. New environments open up, maybe through continental drift, or islands forming like Hawaii.
Ah, like the volcanic islands. New land, no competitors.
Exactly. You get these empty niches, these ecological opportunities, and evolution can run wild, diversifying rapidly to fill them up.
Okay, so that's the making species side. What about the losing species side, extinction?
Extinction is always happening at a low level, kind of a background hum. But Dr. Hoffman focuses on the mass extinction events. These are times when extinction rates suddenly spike drastically.
There have been five big ones in the last half billion years or so.
That's right, the big five. The worst one ever was the Permian extinction, right at the end of the Permian period.
How bad was it?
Catastrophic. Maybe 90%, perhaps even 96% of marine species, huge percentages of terrestrial life, gone, just wiped out.
Wow, what caused it?
The leading hypothesis, as Dr. Hoffman explains, points towards massive, prolonged volcanic activity, particularly in Siberia, releasing enormous amounts of CO2, leading to runaway global warming, ocean acidification, a whole cascade of disasters.
And the most recent big one, the one everyone knows.
That's the Cretaceous extinction, about 65, 66 million years ago. That's the one that took out the non-avian dinosaurs.
Along with about 3/4 of all species on Earth.
Yeah, still massive. And the major trigger there seems pretty clear. A huge asteroid impact down near the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico.
Kicked up so much dust and aerosols it blocked the sun.
Exactly. Photosynthesis collapses, food chains fall apart. But here's the macroevolutionary twist. Wiping out the dominant dinosaurs opened up ecological space.
Space for mammals to take over.
Precisely. Mammals have been around, mostly small, often nocturnal, living in the shadows of the dinosaurs. That extinction event cleared the stage for the age of mammals, which ultimately leads to, well, us.
Okay, this is where Dr. Hoffman's lecture gets particularly relevant, maybe even alarming. He connects this history to the present.
He does. He points out that current extinction rates are soaring, way, way above the normal background rate. many scientists believe we are right at the beginning of a sixth mass extinction event.
But unlike the others caused by volcanoes or asteroids,
this one is being driven by human activity. Habitat destruction, climate change, pollution, overexploitation. It's us.
And Dr. Hoffman draws a direct parallel, doesn't he? Between the Permian cause and today.
He does, and it's chilling. The Permian extinction, the biggest ever, was largely driven by volcanic CO2 causing global warming.
Mm-hmm.
We are now causing global warming through burning fossil fuels, releasing massive amounts of CO2. It's the same fundamental mechanism.
That historical parallel is sobering.
It really is.
It also brings up another fascinating point Dr. Hoffman addressed, this paradox of form. How can you get these huge physical differences between species when their genetics are surprisingly similar?
Right. The classic example is humans and chimpanzees. We look very different, different posture, different skulls, different abilities.
Yet our DNA is something like 98 or 99% identical.
So how does that small genetic difference translate into such big morphological differences? You'd intuitively think massive changes require massive genetic rewiring.
But that's not the case.
Often, no. The key, Dr. Hoffman explains, isn't necessarily what genes you have, but when and where you turn them on and off during development. This concept is called heterochrony.
Hetero meaning different, chrony meaning time, different timing.
Exactly. Differences in developmental timing. Think about the skull again. Humans and chimps have largely the same genes for skull growth.
But in humans,
the timing is such that the brain case keeps growing for longer relative to the jaw. So we end up with a large cranium and a flatter face.
Whereas in chimps,
the jaw region grows more prominently relative to the brain case. Same basic toolkit of genes, just regulated differently in time. Different timing, different outcome.
So it's like tweaking the instructions in the recipe, not changing all the ingredients.
That's a great way to put it. And the tweakers, the master controllers, are developmental genes. Things like the homeotic genes or HOX genes.
These aren't genes for like hair protein or muscle cells.
No, they code for regulatory proteins.
Yay.
Think of them like master switches on a control panel. Their job is to turn other genes, the structural genes, on or off at the right time and in the right place during embryonic development.
So a small change, a mutation in one of these HOX genes
can have huge downstream effects. Yeah. It can change the whole body plan. Like Dr. Hoffman mentioned how changes in HOX gene expression are involved in determining where limbs form or how many segments an insect has.
Or the bat wing example.
Perfect example. Bats didn't evolve totally new genes for wings. Changes in the regulation of existing genes caused the finger bones in their hand to grow incredibly long, forming the framework for the wing membrane. Small genetic input, massive morphological output.
This also helps explain how complex structures can evolve gradually, right? The classic argument against evolution is, what good is half an eye?
Right, the argument from irreducible complexity. But Dr. Hoffman, like many biologists, shows how that's flawed. You can trace a plausible step-by-step evolution of the eye where every single intermediate stage provides a selective advantage.
Okay, walk us through it.
You start simple, maybe just a patch of light-sensitive cells on the skin. Is that an eye?
No.
Is it useful? Yes. You can detect light versus dark, maybe tell if a shadow passes overhead.
Advantage one. Then?
Then maybe that patch slightly cups inward, forms a shallow pit. Now, light coming from different directions hits different cells. You can sense the direction of light. Big advantage for finding food or avoiding predators.
Okay, getting better.
Then, imagine the opening to that pit narrows, maybe gets covered by a transparent layer, trapping some fluid. That fluid can act as a very basic lens, focusing light slightly. You might get a blurry image. First step towards image formation.
Still useful.
Absolutely. Then, maybe that fluid lens gets replaced by actual cells, forming a clearer, more defined lens. Better focus.
Yeah.
Then maybe muscles attached to the lens, allowing you to change the focus, like autofocus.
Then each step makes the structure work better.
Exactly. Each step is an improvement favored by natural selection. It shows how complexity can build incrementally, and the fact that eyes have evolved independently multiple times in different lineages shows how powerful that selective pressure is.
Wow. Okay, so this deep dive took us from like 4.6 billion years ago through grifting continents and shifting bones.
All the way down to the timing switches in developmental genes.
Yeah, showing how these huge macroevolutionary patterns emerge from geological forces and surprisingly subtle genetic tweaks over vast amounts of time.
And if we circle back to maybe the most critical point Dr. Hoffman raised, linking the past to our present.
The extinction data.
The extinction data. It's incredibly sobering. He emphasized that analysis of the past five mass extinctions shows a strong correlation for four of them, with global temperature increases of just 1 to 3 degrees Celsius.
Only 1 to 3 degrees triggering mass extinction events.
That's what the geological record suggests. And we are currently on a trajectory well within and potentially exceeding that range due to human-caused climate change. The parallel with the Permian, driven by CO2-induced warming, is right there in the data.
It really puts our current moment into a stark, deep-time perspective. Which leads to a final thought, maybe a provocative question for you, the listener.
Go on.
Well, the Cretaceous extinction wiped out the dinosaurs and paved the way for the rise of mammals our age. If we are, as Dr. Hoffman and many others suggest, initiating a sixth mass extinction, what comes next? What kind of species or what type of species might be best positioned to survive the changes we're causing and thrive in the world that comes after this human-driven Anthropocene event? Something to ponder.